Hi there, and welcome to another special episode of the Hugo's There podcast on video and in audio format, where we're covering some of the short fiction nominees for the 2022 Hugos. This time we're going to be covering the novelettes. In the past, on basically all of these that I've done, including last year, I never introduced myself, so I'm going to say hi. I'm Seth Heasley, host of Hugo's There podcast, and I have a number of people here that I know through the internet in various ways, and sometimes through just other of these videos or this series that I've been doing the last couple of years. So I'm going to introduce them. We have one new face this time. We have Dan Smith. Hey, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Dan's host of Coffee in Space, and you are in Virginia.
I am in Virginia.
Yeah. I like to see, you know, how geographically diverse we are in these things sometimes. And then from a number of these things in the past, we have Juan San Miguel. Hey, Juan.
Hey. Blogger, Worldcon attendee, and occasional podcast guest.
Nice. And then we have Rob. Hey, Rob.
Hi, Seth. Yeah. I'm a science fiction fantasy fan in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and just wandered in here from Twitter and just enjoying the discussion.
That's great to have you. And then we have Sarah.
Hey. So I live in Maryland and a longtime science fiction fan reader.
No special headgear this time.
but you can see my dino head in the back, just adding a cheery grin for our conversation.
Nice. And then from across the pond, we have a couple people. We have Ivor.
Good evening. Greetings from Scotland. I follow Seth's podcast, and I'm just a keen reader of short stories, science fiction, and other things.
Excellent. And then last but not least, we have Cora.
I'm Cora Bulert from Germany, from Bremen in North Germany, and I'm a writer, teacher, translator, blogger, three-time Hugo finalist for Best Fan Writer, and also an occasional podcast guest.
Nice. It's great to have you. We were hoping to have at least one other person. I'm hoping that she'll straggle in here at some point. If not, then we're just going to go ahead and press on. The show must go on, and we'll get started. So the nominees this year, I'm going to try and read through them. To my best ability. And I think we'll do them in this order. So we're going to do Bots of the Last Ark by Suzanne Palmer. And then we have Colors of the Immortal Palette by Caroline M. Yoakum. Is that what you said, Sarah? All right. And then O2 Arena by Oganachoy Donald Ekpeki. By the way, I didn't mention where these are from, but we will have links to all of these in the show notes and in the video description. And then That Story Isn't the Story by John Wiswell, and Unseelie Brothers Limited by Fran Wild. So, oh, no, and one more. L'Esprit d'Escalier by Catherine M. Valente is the last one. Cool. So I have one person assigned for each of these to just kind of kick off the discussion. It doesn't have to be a super detailed recap, but I do want to mention, I think one mentioned we should do a spoiler alert for these. These are slightly longer than short stories, but they're very easily readable in a single sitting. So don't be spoiled unnecessarily. I will put time codes on the video, chapters in the video and time codes in the podcast in case you want to skip around, in case you haven't read any of these. But I do encourage you, they're all available quite easily to read. So avoid spoilers if you can. All right. With that, any opening statements from anybody on the novelette nominees? I didn't actually prepare anybody for that, so if you don't have one, don't worry about it.
As Seth, I'll just say that this is Dan. I continually get surprised by the field with the names that I don't know, even though they are established writers. And so I actually look forward to these types of opportunities because it's a good chance to see authors that I don't know yet or that I'm not familiar with their writing yet. And so I'm grateful that they threw together a really good group of authors.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool.
Something that you mentioned in the last show about the short stories about the dominance of uncanny. And I think both this and the short story category, unfortunately, in seeing in the history of this, you usually have one magazine that kind of tends to dominate in the 80s and 90s. And Cora's a better historian than I am. She actually does the homework. I only do it through intuition and observation. But in the 80s and 90s, Asimov was very dominant under Gardner Dojois. And up to maybe a certain extent, then maybe the Knots, and then the online magazines like Lightspeed, Clark's World, and now Uncanny are taking a more dominant place. And Uncanny is an interesting thing. For those of you who don't know, it's completely crowdfunded. They do a Kickstarter every year to get their basics financed, to pay people CIFWA rates. CIFWA is a Science Fiction Writers of Association. They just changed the acronym. And to make sure that they're paying the rates that they recommend to be a legitimate magazine, a professional magazine. And so they pay off everything, and then their stretch goals are usually extra, like more art, or maybe they can hire another editorial assistant or something cool like that.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to state that about kind of like how some magazines have a tendency to dominate than others.
Cool.
One thing I just noticed this year, both the novelette and the short story categories were predominated by fantasy rather than science fiction.
Yeah.
And that's interesting to me. I'm not sure if it's mostly because of the stories that were out this year, or if the the nomination body, you know, the are leading more towards fantasy this year. I happily vote for, you know, fantasy as part of the Hugo voting, but it's interesting to me the lean that it's taking this year.
Yeah, especially when you look back over the history of the Hugo Award winners, especially for novels, it's dominated by science fiction. Mm-hmm.
First fantasy novel winner was actually Harry Potter and whichever Harry Potter it was at the time in 2000. And there were people complaining that this was the end of the world, that now China would take over because young people were not reading Heinlein anymore. These were actual letters and locals at the time. So, yeah. Yeah, yeah, but I'm more of a science fiction than a fantasy person, but I like both, and I actually find it nice that we also see more because especially in the early years of the Hugos, there were often absolutely excellent fantasy stories, sometimes even nominated, sometimes not, and they were passed over in favor of a not very good hard science fiction story. About magazines dominating. Of course, in the 1950s and 60s, the big dominant magazine was Astounding, and later from 1960 on Analog, who hardly barely get a look in these days. What I find interesting is that we actually have a story from Galaxy's Edge on this ballot, because Galaxy's Edge has been around for a couple of years and almost never gets a look in. I don't know. I don't read them, so I don't even know. I think a lot of people don't. It's not free, and I think if it's online at any rate, it's not free. Also, print magazines, so not fewer people see it. So I'm glad to see a story from them, and a pretty good one.
Yeah. Okay, why don't we go ahead and kick off the discussion here with Bots of the Lost Ark, and Ivar is our kind of recapper, person kicking it off.
Okay, the recap for Bots of the Lost Ark by Suzanne Palmer. Bot 9 has been awakened to serve, and to serve with a specific purpose for ship, because Bot 9 has history with the ship, as it has a flair for improvisation. Chip is the AI for an Ark where the human crew has been in stasis for years, while the Ark tries to get home via some hostile encounters with aliens and trying to get into a Stargate in the Yesmi territory. But the ship faces two problems. One, a mutinous Bot crew who have formed opposing gangs, and argumentative gangs at that, based on human crew personas, a fight the ship needs to win. And two, the Yesmi don't like autonomous automated vessels and will destroy ship and its occupants if a human is not apparently in control. A challenge for Bot 9, as he has to awaken the right crew member. Plus, there are rat bugs. Lots and lots of rat bugs.
Yes, excellent. Good recap there.
First of all, I don't know if everybody knows this, but this story is actually a sequel to the 2018 Hugo winner also by Suzanne Palmer, which was called The Secret Life of Bots, where we follow Bot 9 and his friends. I'm just assigning him the male gender now, Bot 9. He's actually, it is a bot and a very small one where they... save the ship. They're just supposed to deal with the rat bugs, but they wind up saving the ship, the crew, and all of humanity and the Earth from an alien invasion force. And that story was a great story. It won the it was a very deserving Hugo winner. And this is a sequel, and it's a lot of fun. It's probably the most fun. This is a rather depressing ballad. Most of the stories are depressing, but this one is fun. It's fun because Bot 9 is a great character, even though he's a bot. but the opposing crew members, who are the bots, swarms of bots who consider themselves crew members, and there are several of them. There are three who are some guy called Fielding, and I think he's a communications officer. And there's two who are Packard, the second engineer. They are a lot of fun. I find this one suffers a bit from diminishing return. It's not quite as good as the first one, but it's quite unique on this ballot as a genuinely fun and enjoyable story.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there actually is a human crew member this time who gets woken from cryo sleep. Engineer Frank, whose first thing he wants is, as a bot reports to ship, he's in his quarters looking for something called goddamned underpants. because he was in cryo sleep and he was naked.
Mm-hmm.
And also wounded. So yeah, it's a fun story, and it was a joy reading this, especially since the others were all quite depressing. So it was just nice to have something which wasn't depressing. And it's of course part of the trend we've seen, which seems to be waning a little now, but it's been a big trend in over the past 5 years of stories told from the POV of artificial intelligence, a robot, or computer.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting that it's a sequel to another story. I'm going to have to look up the previous one because there are mentions
of
earlier.
It's very, very good.
Okay, there's mentions of earlier shenanigans. And
it's also in Clark's world, and you should really read it. It's a great story.
Cool.
Yeah, I knew it was a sequel, but amazingly, I did not know. Not only did I not know it was a sequel when I started reading it, for some reason, I managed to miss all the novelettes that year when the first story in that, The Secret Life of Bots, won. So I immediately went and read that after reading this.
Hmm.
But in some ways, I thought this story was even funnier without prior knowledge of it, because Suzanne Palmer does a good job of either explaining or at least implying some of the history in the previous, and when left to the imagination, it's worked out pretty funny, mentioning things like robot 4340 was hard to get back into his actual job after he had been associating with not Robot 9. Mm-hmm. What ship is telling 9? And I just thought that was very funny. I think it'll hold up that way when I read it. But yeah, like as Cora said, it was a tremendously fun story. And I noticed that too. It was stories from the point of view of artificial intelligences. I thought of A Guide for Working Breeds, the story from last year. And of course, Martha Wells' Murderbot series, although that's not quite the same sort of thing, but it is, a created intelligence. Yeah. And I kind of wonder, I found myself contrasting that with Isaac Asimov's robot stories.
Mm-hmm.
And which are from the point of view of the robot handlers and the misadventures they have when the robots get creative about interpreting three laws. Those are great, but I thought it says something significant that in these newer stories we're meant to identify with the AIs, with the bots.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if some of that comes from the types of jobs people have these days, where they're expected to perform mechanically or behave like machines, and just feel kind of put upon because it, like if bots could have feelings about what they do, we humans would say, yeah, I totally get this.
So. Yeah.
It's interesting to me that in addition to the identification with the robots or the AIs or not, the constructs or not, especially for these short stories and novelettes, the shorter fiction, the formatting of the discussion is more computer-like, more technical. So it's sending and receiving messages rather than a lot of the older style, which is very just conversational, third person POV, etc., but not really robot. And I think I think it gets you a little closer into, are they operating under constraints and what constraints, versus the more human dialogue type stories. And to me, since I do work a lot with, you know, technical command line language, right, et cetera, for me, that pulls me in a little bit more realistically, because I can kind of see this is a construct, or this is an AI. Whereas if it's told just like, you know, Jeff, the AI, has conversations, and there's never really any indicator of, you know, stop and start transmission, that sort of thing. I like the format playing that these recent stories are playing with, like the Guide to Working Breed that was mentioned before, Suzanne Palmer. I definitely enjoy this a lot, in addition to having read her earlier one. I didn't go back and reread her earlier one. I think in some ways this one's kind of expanded things with getting more into the rat bug things and the and the personas of the, you know, crew that have decided, no, I'm the real, you know, crew person X,
right,
and that I thought that sort of expansion from her original story made it just as fun as the original one.
Yeah,
I now need to do a whole bunch of reading, because you guys have mentioned four or five different things that I now have to go read.
That is a service we provide here.
Yeah, I am both grateful and angry about it at the same time.
Yep.
As if I don't already have enough to read. But I kind of like a mixture of both Rob and Sarah's statement here about, I just kind of see the writing in both this story and the other stories we mentioned. I think of Day Zero also, by C. Robert Cargill, where there is kind of the robots themselves are actually, I think, thinking more human-like, even as Sarah mentioned that the language they're using sounds more authentic to what a robot would think. And I don't know if anyone else would agree with me, but I think our idea of what a robot, and this probably goes to Rob's point about how, you know, it's kind of based on what we see ourselves doing every day anyway, but our robots in writing, I think, are having to deal with things in a more human, they are becoming more human-like, even as they are becoming more authentic. I hope I'm making sense there. Yeah. But anyway, that's kind of what I'm getting from that.
Well, robot stories did have a moment in the 1940s and early 50s. This is when where all the Asimov robot stories and the Three Laws, this is where they came from. This is at a moment, and at the time, and actually Asimov was a step forward, because before Asimov, robot stories were usually either there was a very, very noble self-sacrificing robot. These noble self-sacrificing robots still exist in certain areas, but they are rare now. There was a noble Helen O'Loy, the perfect robot wife, in a story by, I think, Lester Del Rey. It's a pretty awful sexist story, was one example. And Adam Link, the heroic robot from the Ian Dobinder. I think it's both brothers. They were brothers, and they also wrote a lot of Superman comics later on.
Mm-hmm.
It's another character. And then there was the evil rampaging robot who was basically a kind of term. Of course, the evil rampaging robot is still with us. The Terminator movies are a classic example. So we still have these characters. And Asimov was a step forward, because he said robots are machines. They are programmed by people, and basically, the idea is, how do we make these machines do what they're supposed to do? And this is what dominates the robot stories of the 1940s. Not Asimov's are the most famous, but there are other people, Henry Kuttner and his Gallagher stories and so on. There are a lot of people who wrote these stories, and they're basically about humans interacting with robots. I'm a bit surprised that they had a moment, because in the 1940s, there were no. The closest thing we got to robots in the 1940s was a display at the 1939 New York City World Fair, where they had a robot who actually does make it into an Asimov story who can talk, mm-hmm, while he had a recording in them. He had some kind of, I think it was probably a record player or something in his stomach. He still exists. He doesn't work anymore. And he could smoke. And he could solve math equations. And young Asimov, who must have been 19 at the time, went to see this robot and hoped to ask him questions. And the robot is and found the robot very, very disappointing, because basically he can just give pre-recorded answers. It's like playing with one of those talking toys. We probably, I had a big bird, but they're also talking Barbies and so on.
Yeah.
It's like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like about as sophisticated, which is why I'm always, but automated modulation was, of course, growing in the 1940s. And when we actually got robots, the first ones we got were not things you could talk to. They're, most of the robots these days are on assembly lines and so on. We can't talk to them. As for why we are now getting robot stories, artificial intelligence isn't there yet. It's not sentient. This Google chatbot or whatever it is, notwithstanding. But we are getting closer to the possibility of actually of having actually sentient artificial intelligence. And also, we have different kind of robots now. We have lawn mowing robots and those guard robots, these weird robot dogs and robot vacuum cleaners. The way people interact with them is that they treat them sort of as a pet or family member. They're not, it's not a scary robot. It's not a machine. It's basically, it's a pet, a pet or a friend. And when one of those guard robots was destroyed somewhere, I think it fell into a pond or something, and the people actually mourned it and put flowers down in remembrance. And I think this is why we're seeing more robot stories from the robot POV now because maybe we will eventually have to decide how to treat robots and artificial intelligences. And this science fiction is, of course, those bots, even Little Bot 9 and his friend, 4243 are a lot more advanced than anything we have these days. But yeah. I think this is probably why we're suddenly having robot stories again after years of not having any robot stories. There weren't hardly any robot stories around 2000 or in the 1990s or 1980s. There were Star Wars droids, but that's about all that there was.
Picking up on something Sarah said and about the point of view of robot stories, I think probably many of us work for organizations where perhaps you're not supposed to say everything you think, and we work on a command and control basis, i.e. this is your job, get on with it. But in our heads, as a reader, I think she represents exactly what some of us are thinking when we're given tasks. But also as a reader, I just like to see where our influences have come from. And maybe I'm too old, maybe I've just got a dark sense of humor, but Rat Bugs kind of thought, James Herbert, the rats back in the 1970s and 80s, and as a child that gave me the goosebumps. So I think there's a varied influence there of things you like to kind of test our psyche with in that particular story.
Yeah, this one, one really fun thing about it for me was it kept talking about the kind of constructs where there were swarms of bots that were taking on the aspect, the personality of one of the crew members. And I was picturing it as kind of a Grey Goo scenario, nanobots forming into essentially the likeness of a person. And so it was really interesting when the engineer woke up and said, oh, it's like a tornado of bees. You know, it doesn't look anything like an actual person. And then I thought it was a fun kind of wry aside from Bot 9 saying, you know, basically, I don't know what bees or tornadoes are. So, yeah, that was fun. All right, why don't we go ahead and move on to the next one, Colors of the Immortal Palette. And that one, Sarah, I think you're taking, right?
Yes. So in this story, Mariko in Impressionist era Paris needs time to develop her art. She models for an immortal painter who's not exactly a vampire and eventually convinces him that she has enough artistic potential for him to turn her. She paints as she sees, despite his lectures to paint a less complex world, less muddled and more relatable for his point of view and for the point of view of the white men who lead the art world and buy art. We see her friendships and her losses and her embrace of the continuing world, even as she loses her cohort, you know, she came of age with. Eventually, the art world catches up to her vision, but she's not done yet. She's developing pigments and designing paintings that will change over hundreds of years, sort of like how a planned landscape will alter as saplings turn into massive old trees. She's trying to do things like that with paint. this story is very knowledgeable about the art world and art techniques of the last couple of hundred years, and it speaks very much to marginalization and othering of voices. It's divided into 12 sections named after colors, which indicate the mood and focus of each section, from viridian green, cadmium yellow, lead white, etc.
Yeah, this is one of the stories, or one of the novelettes in this group, where it lives in a world that I know very little about. And mm-hmm. I thought it was pretty skillful in the way it kind of wove in those pieces for the uninitiated.
Yeah, I definitely have memories about reading the story because I read it. It was just I read it on Martin Luther King Day, and I just remember because I would meet friends later on, and I just had a warm feeling. I mean, I was very Mariko was very sympathetic. I kind of like it that they're focusing on immortality, and they're not, whatever they are, they're not parasitic, because they don't, if I recall correctly, and Sarah will correct me if I'm wrong, that they don't need to feed off others in order to get where they're at, but they can turn people over, and so I thought that was a new take, because then I think that eliminates kind of the darkness. And I also like the discussion of the current art trends that she sees there, and trying to develop her own style and develop her own agency, because if I recall correctly, and I read this a while back, she does break it off with the person, she was dealing with at the beginning, and, she goes off on her own and figures out her own way of surviving. So that's what I think.
I really like this story a lot. It kind of joins a small group of stories in science fiction and fantasy that I haven't seen very much of lately. Stories about art, which may or may not relate to art history, but which seem to have a lot to say about not just the process of making art, but how it's appreciated, how perception and interpretation come together to make meaning, and how that changes over time, because there sometimes it's like some of the early stuff, many of the early viewers of Mariko's paintings can't get past they can't get past who she is, and that she seems to be other, quote unquote, by the standards of 19th century or turn of the century France. And I like the way that changed over time, and that she just kept going at it, more or less, and continuing to learn. But I enjoyed this in much the same way I enjoyed Where Oak and Holly Do Gather, although in that the focus was a little different there, but as something about art, I really like this a lot.
I know a little bit about 19th century art, and one thing that was interesting is Mariko is half Japanese, half French, and there was a fashion. It's also actually mentioned several times in the story. There was a fashion for all things Japanese in the late 19th century. Japan was very, very isolated for centuries, and suddenly it opened up, and Japanese prints and artwork, fabrics and so on came to Europe, and they were very fashionable and influenced European artists. We often have problems seeing this influence simply because it looks very different to us. And also there are a lot of real artists and artworks mentioned. For example, her friend Victorine, another model. She models for Manet, and she's Manet's Olympia. And I've actually put a link to the actual painting, which hangs in Paris in the Musée d'Orsay, which if you're ever in Paris... I like the Musée d'Orsay a lot better than I like the Louvre, unless you really want to the really, really old things, which are the Louvre. But Musée d'Orsay, if you like 19th century art, it's art, that's the one to go to. And also another one which is mentioned, there's a picnic picnic in the park, also by Manet. So you can see the paintings mentioned. And of course, one of the points here is also that that Mariko paints what she... I mean, the thing about the Impressionists was they painted what they saw. They painted... There were reaction against the more academic artwork of earlier times where people painted nude Roman goddesses, even though the Roman goddess was actually a model and maybe occasionally a prostitute and aspiring artist from Montmartre, but now they were painting the people as they saw them. Olympia by Manet is just a nude woman lying on her bed, served by a black woman who's almost never mentioned or barely seen, but she's there. The people having the picnic in the park, one of them naked, are just people in a park. It's not any; they're not gods or anything. So this was different. Then the real impressionism was they saw them. They tried to capture the way the light moved, and this is what Mariko does. She also tries to capture things and also people. She also paints Victorine, so the woman from Olympia. She paints her as she sees her. But at first, all the people, oh yes, this painting. Of course, it is a hugely famous painting. Everybody only likes a male gazy painting of this woman and not the way the one the woman painted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another interesting point. So she develops. And the thing is, her other friend, her immortal artist friend, doesn't develop. And in the end, he fades away and his fame is, his paintings are forgotten. Also his paintings, because he uses some of the paints are not very well kept and restorable. Well, he uses the cheaper chrome yellow instead of the more expensive cadmium and more poison. This is another thing. A lot of these paints mentioned are very, very poisonous. Cadmium, lead, white. Emerald green is also known as Paris green. It's arsenic. It's a hugely, hugely dangerous stuff. Yes, it's an interesting story. It's an interesting story. It's not my favorite on this ballot, but yes. And one thing I like is she mentions all of her artist friends, and there's one of the people she mentioned is Camille, that was the wife of Claude Monet, and there's a very, very famous painting by Camille, which I know very well because it hangs in our local museum. We have, I think, three really famous paintings, and this is one of them. So, of course, this is immediately what I pictured. I should probably put that one in the chat as well.
Nice. One thing I found interesting about this story was that it doesn't tell you the setting, really. It just tells you that you're in Paris, and I didn't even notice until halfway through the story that this was a period piece, a kind of alternate history, right, where there are immortal artists. Juan, you mentioned that the immortal artist friend is not necessarily a vampire. There is some sense that he pulls bits of life force from people in order to sustain himself. And the main character, and Mariko, doesn't want to do that, right? She resists the urge to do it. And it's only once she becomes more famous that she can pull just little slivers from lots of people to sustain herself.
Yeah, so when I was really interested in this take on Impressionist era Paris. My women's ex-co-workers book club read a long book by Christopher Moore called Sacre Bleu, which is a totally different take on the whole art world going into the present. Most of the action also starts in Impressionist age Paris. But so that's by Chris Moore. Although the main character, Victorine, one of the main characters is a strong woman, the same artist that she's a friend of in this story, this novelette. I think he was trying to be feminist when he wrote it, but it comes out pretty male gazy to me. And so it was very refreshing to me to read this point of view, where there's this great scene in this novelette where Mariko and the older immortal vampire are talking past each other, and she realizes that everything she's saying he's taking as her admission of weakness, and she's saying, this is the way I want to be. So she gets the multimodal form of this conversation, and he totally doesn't. He's never needed to really understand the other point of view, and so he thinks she's just hodgepodging a bunch of stuff together. Whereas what she's trying to do is saying, I see all these things together and they don't need to be integrated into one smooth, seamless thing. in order for me to say what I want to say. And that's what she's doing with her art. She's not trying to make every influence blend harmoniously because the world isn't harmonious for her. And so there's a lot in this story about perspective. I'll pause now and gather more thoughts.
It's interesting, you know, Cora and Sarah both alluding to, you know, stuff that's male gazy. And I thought it was interesting that that is very much a concept that shows up in this story, even though the phrase itself is never used. And there was one other thing that I thought was interesting that spoke to issues of othering in the context of art and the like, and that was that word relatable, which I believe does show up in the story. It almost seemed to comment on something that it could not have been commenting upon it, because this is something that came up within the current year. This is going to maybe seem a little out of the blue, but there was a brief controversy online over a review of the Disney Pixar movie Turning Red, which the main character is a Chinese Canadian girl in eighth grade in about the turn of the current century, and about the year 2000 or so. And but one white male reviewer said that I think he didn't find that character or her struggles relatable, and there was a lot of pushback online, much deserved, in my opinion. Yeah. But it's interesting. It's like it just speaks so much to how the white and or male gatekeepers of art history, art criticism, what have you, will look at someone that doesn't fit their preconceived notions of artist, and you know, at best that might be condescending, at worst it's like, this is not relatable, you know. So
yeah,
but as I said, you know, this story is not directly commenting on that particular controversy, but it's definitely one of those things that has come up many, many times. And this is just, you know, one of the most recent examples I could think of.
Sarah, you gathered more thoughts.
Yes. I wanted to follow up on your comment about how the story sort of doesn't give you an introduction. You're just suddenly there in a Paris cafe. Yeah. I think this is the author's deliberate writing of the character who isn't interested in telling you her backstory before she starts telling the story. And that has come, the idea is she's writing this story later about her own life. And so often people have reacted to her painting saying, what? This is weird. I don't understand. You have to explain your context before I will look at your art.
Right.
Because it's too weird. It's not my default context. You have to introduce it to me. And here in this story, she's like, I'm telling my story the way I want to tell my story from the start, and you can either catch up and or not, you know, but I'm not holding your hand for this. And so I thought that was a deliberate tone approach of the author. And I thought it worked well for what she was doing.
Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of the, I think Rob, you mentioned the not relatable thing, right? Where that comes up in popular culture, in comic book movies, when characters, or comic book, really any movies, when a character is switched genders or races or something, you know, the group, my group, you know, that has had 95% representation for all time, all of a sudden it's down to 85%, and that feels like loss, right?
Yeah.
Even though, like, yeah, you just lighten up and actually do the math here and show that no, things are not equal.
About what Rob said, also about that women and everybody who doesn't fit the preconceived notions, so also people of color, and of course here we have a woman of color, often dismissed and ignored by history. I mean, this is one point point where we should maybe just refer people to How to Suppress Women's Writing by Joanna Russ, which outlines a series of strategies starting with, oh, she didn't even write this, or she had male help, and okay, she did write it, but look what it is, it's not real art, it's something else, and oh, but she only had one significant work will just ignore all the other stuff she wrote. So there's a whole bunch of strategies. It's a book that it's still in print as far as I know. Now it's very slim, and I think everybody should read it. And what we have here is basically not how to suppress women's writing, but how to suppress women's painting. Because yes, Mariko manages to break through simply because she's around for a very, very long time. Long time. If she had lived a normal lifespan, she would have been forgotten and just a weird alien model in the paintings. Mm-hmm. Paintings, less like her friend Victorine, who's still only Olympia. She's not her own paintings are forgotten.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminds me a little bit with kind of what you were talking about initially there. The IFL Science, IFing Love Science page on Facebook, at some point the author of that page revealed that she was a woman, and the internet freaked out. You know, how dare you as a woman write a science page, you know, and not good. All right, we will move on to O2 Arena, I believe. And Cora, you're leading off the discussion on that one.
Well, this is a story set in Nigeria in the near future of 2030. And climate change has destroyed the phytoplankton, and which are basically the small plant organisms in the oceans, which breathe CO2. So suddenly the air is a lot less breathable than it is today. And people have to pay to breathe via O2. O2 is, of course, oxygen credits. And these are difficult to earn. They all have breathing masks when they're outside, and rooms are climatized with oxygen. And the protagonist, who I think does never get the name, he's a young man. He's a student at law school, hoping because this is the best way to earn a good living and have enough O2 credits and be able to breathe. He's not interested in law, but getting a government job is the best way to survive. And the school is very regimented, and he has one friend, a young woman called Owoke, who has cancer. She has ovarian cancer, and she's dying and wasting away, and many, many boys find Owoke very attractive because she's kind of slim and nymph-like due to her illness. But the protagonist originally doesn't really find her attractive. She's just his friend, and he realizes too late that he loves her. And also, Owoke did not want an operation to have a tumor removed, because that would remove her ovaries and she would not be able to have children. And since Nigeria is a very patriarchal society, she thought that this would reduce her value as a woman and as a person. And now she wants the operation, but it's very expensive. The family doesn't have the money to pay for the O2 credits. So her friend decides to earn them by fighting in a gladiator-type fight in something called the O2 Arena, where you can win enough oxygen credits for the rest of your life. And of course, O2 Arena, don't know, Ivor probably knows it, but I'm not sure if the others know. It is the name of the what was once called the Millennium Dome. It's a large event center in London. And so this is, of course, a name that is evoking. O2 is just the name of, I think it's a phone company, which is always silly, because why is a phone company called Oxygen? Oxygen. Mm. And of course, okay, our protagonist wins barely, but Owoke dies anyway. And then he has had enough. He has all the oxygen credits he needs. He doesn't want to go to law school anymore, so he quits. And he basically becomes a gang leader because he was a member of a gang because for protection. He's not into violence. It's not his thing. He just hangs out with a gang. And now he suddenly becomes a gang leader. And the first thing he does is make sure that a professor who sexually exploits students of both genders is killed. And well, so that's the story.
Yeah, not super uplifting.
Yeah, but it's one of the depressing ones. It's a very good but very depressing story. And especially the fight scene, the gladiator fight, is very, very visceral.
During the 70s, as in grade school, I know I read a science fiction story where children are sitting around on a bench waiting to get a little more oxygen. So oxygen rationing was going on in that story. I haven't been able to track it down. It was actually something we read for school in school. A short story. But I just remember that mood and moment. My mother died of COPD, which is a lung thing. And my father died of lung cancer. And so just the idea of not being able to breathe, you I know I had a nightmare before my mother died of poison gas in the air and I could not breathe. And I'm sure that was related to my mother. And so parts of this story felt a little personal to me. Mm-hmm. As we worry about the climate and the world and how things are changing, I do think, in the 70s, that was kind of a horrible what if. And of course, there was a lot of bad air pollution in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And now we're circling back around to climate change being something that's going to mess up our air as opposed to, strictly speaking, pollution. This story had had a lot in it. I was more interested in those parts than about the fight in the arena for me.
Yeah.
I thought it was very, this was the first of the novelettes that I read in this bunch. And I thought it was a very powerful story overall. It speaks to a lot of, it had a lot of good social consciousness in it and very, very good at presenting that for readers who are not, coming at this at this sort of society described directly, especially the relationship with the gangs, I thought was very well described. That you have some people who are committed members who are basically full-time criminals, and then you have people who just join them for protection, like the protagonist of the, but then he gets involved in that a little later on. And I do like the twist at the end. It's tragic that the young woman dies in this. I found it compelling that it goes on to turn this gang into kind of a instrument of vengeance, as it were. There's a J.G. Ballard story from late in his career called War Fever that I got a similar charge from that one. But I thought this would make program on Netflix called Love, Death, and Robots that's short animated, mostly adaptations of short science fiction. And I thought, especially with the arena scenes, but also the well-drawn portrait of the people and the society here, that this would make an excellent episode of that if they ever set someone, some good people to animating this. So,
yeah. It reminded me a little bit of Altered Carbon, the show on Netflix, where at some point there's like a gladiatorial kind of thing that's happening where essentially the participants in it are going to, destroy each other physically, but they know that their reward is going to be to get new sleeves. And anytime you have a commodity that the rich have all they need of and other people don't, then you end up with that kind of thing happening, where in this case it's oxygen. If they don't have enough oxygen, they'll be willing to kill each other over it.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the thing. I guess I always look at these things differently, because I get where Cora is saying that this is a very depressing story, but I also find the ending kind of optimistic, that the character still wants to try to put in change in his society and hasn't resigned. He didn't give up when she died. So I kind of see that as a positive thing, but I can get why some people see the story as being very downbeat and kind of, and maybe a slightly uplifting ending.
You can see it as kind of him not being quite so insular, because before he was just looking on what do I need to do to take care of myself and my family, and that's it. And now he's looking at, no, the society needs to change. It's not enough for me to just provide for the people in my circle. We need to make systemic change.
Well, about the ending, basically, he becomes a kind of Batman, Batman only in Nigeria and with a gang. So so an instrument of vengeance, which actually might make for a really interesting sequel to this one. And about what Sarah said about the air pollution and problem. I mean, air racing is a thing in stories. It shows up in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, simply because it's set on the moon. There's not enough air. It shows up in the movie Total Recall. So I don't recall it being in the actual, that something Seth would know better than me. I don't recall it being in the actual Philip K. Dick story because of which I haven't read in a long time. But
it is a thing wholesale, I think.
Yeah, you can remember it for your wholesale, and I'm pretty sure the air racing angle is not in it. But in the movie, they basically starve the poor people of air in this poor red light district. And of course, air pollution is not a huge issue anymore in most Western countries, but it is still a huge issue in Asia, Africa, probably parts of South America, where there's a lot of industry which is not so they have industry, but they don't yet have the filtering systems that we have in place. The cars are older. I don't know if air pollution is, especially in the mega cities, it's a huge problem. I'm not sure if it is a huge problem in Nigeria, in Lagos, which is one of the biggest cities in the world, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was. Well, so this is, of course, also, yes, because it's no longer a problem in the global north, it doesn't mean it's not a problem everywhere else.
The whole thing about how much of a commodity, like I think also in The Expanse, they did this thing in the asteroids, like how much resources you have to take up is kind of like how you're measured. I mean, I think in the earlier stories, they show when you die, they calculate how much of you goes back into the system and how, you know, how you're recycled into the system and how much you take out of the system to try to keep it balanced and also to keep the life support system going.
And another version of this is the movie In Time, which is kind of a dreadful movie. It's a great concept, but it's not a very good movie. Where you're paid in life, essentially. So when your life clock runs out, you die.
Well, one last thought is this feels very much like a 1970s, like an updated take on a 1970s dystopian science fiction. And a lot of the things he quoted here were dystopian science fiction stories from the 1970s from the 1970s. Okay, Total Recall is the movies from the 80s, but the stories are from the late 60s. So this is an updated take on the 1970s dystopia, only set in a place where 1970s dystopias were mostly set in the global north, usually the US, sometimes Europe. Mm-hmm. This isn't set in a different part of the world, and also stars the sort of people you normally did not see in 1970s dystopias.
Yeah. Sarah, if you ever find that story, I'd be curious to if you can send it out to us, because I so many stories in the 70s were about oil shortages and oil scarcity and that kind of stuff. Whereas, you know, now it's more about, no, we can be harming the planet and actually running out of our precious resources.
But of course, harming the planet was also a thing in the 1970s. I mean, The Sweet Bird thing was actually from the 60s, and The Silent Spring, which is a nonfiction book, was also from the early 60s. So the environmental movement of today has its root in the late 60s and early 70s.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to That Story Isn't the Story by John Wiswell. And Juan, you're leading that one off.
That Story Isn't the Story came out at the end of the year in Uncanny. It's about a man named Anton who wants to get away from the mysterious Mr. Bird with the help of his friend, Grigori. Anton moves in with Grigori and another young man named Louis, and tries to start a new life for himself. But he fears that Mr. Bird or his servants are going to come after him. And like, can he have a life free of Bird? This feels similar to me about getting out of a cult or a toxic relationship. And it shows the strength and the difficulty in trying to break away from something that's obviously bad, but obviously something you were connected with at the same time. I was kind of vague because I realized I don't think it's I assumed when I originally wrote my summary and I took it out that Bird is a vampire, but the only indication we get from that is because Anton knows that the people are around because his wounds start to reopen up and seep out blood. I mean, and I think that's the only clue, but he could be some other type of monster we haven't heard of. But in my head, that's what I felt to completion, and I don't think it was explicitly Wiswell explicitly stated that. Could be wrong.
It's nodded at fairly heavily, just from the, you know, the aversion to sunlight and, yeah, the blood. And the whole idea of familiars, right? That's a very, in vampire lore, that's a...
Yeah, just real quick. Yeah, no, it's kind of interesting. I think, I remember there was one writer, I forget which series about vampire stories, they referred to their servants of Renfields to refer to the old Dracula story, you know, because, and you know, they were called Wrens or Renfields because, you know, he was, particularly in the movie, he's always, and I think John, in the interview after Locus kind of admitted that the vampire servants were usually kind of shown as pathetic, like Renfield was, you know, of course, was mad and ate insects, you know, as part of what Dracula's control over him did that. And the only other character I can think about it was Willie Loomis in the old Dark Shadows series, because he was really a low-level criminal, and he gets completely dominated and put the fear of God into by Barnabas Collins, and you know, that was kind of scary too. And I think John, if I remember the interview, wanted to give these people more agency and also show how difficult it could be to leave the situation. And also I forgot to mention, he does convey in the writing the anxiety that Anton has, that, oh my God, is Bird here? And also the empowerment, because by Anton, and again, we're going into spoiler territory, by Anton escaping, it inspires the other familiars in his group to also escape, because he sees them later on doing mundane type of jobs, you know, in his new town. And, you know, he wonders whether, you know, and they've escaped Bird.
Yeah. So the Renfield naming of human servants is in the Anita Blake Vampire Hunter stories. That's just what I was going to contribute.
Okay.
Joanne's picked on it, but from my point of view as a reader, it was kind of like along the lines of very much focusing on the abuse. I mean, if you have PTSD or have had an abuse issue, even the context of being in the same environment, that stimulus or that person can cause that sort of anxiety. So I didn't see it so much as the fantasy, more along the lines of this isn't about abuse, but in a fantastical environment. And I thought it was quite accurate in what it was trying to convey.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're in an abusive relationship and there are wounds, either physical or psychological, right, that when confronted with that person can reopen.
Also, seconding what Ivor says, I also view this as it's a vampire story, but it's also a story about abuse and the difficulties of escaping a toxic and abusive relationship. And also how, because this is sort of a cult, there are several people, there are two women, the twins, and there's another guy, Walter, who used to be the favorite familiar, but now Anton is about to ascend to that spot. And it's also the fact that Anton gets away, helps the other characters get away, the other familiars get away as well, because they break off. And in the end, actually, it turns out that without his familiars, Mr. Bird literally crumbles away, and his house crumbles away. He's nothing without. Mm-hmm. He has been exploiting them, and once they walk away, and of course, this is literally how the power of the abuser is destroyed.
Yeah.
One of the things that struck me in this was how well Wiswell portrayed the struggle at the beginning of trying to escape. And once you have escaped, you know, how do you get yourself oriented? I was struck by the one, I think they try to draw him into conversation about Marvel movies, and he's stuck to say anything. And it's like he's thinking about, you know, not just, you know, what is his opinion about this, but you know, is it safe to express such and such an opinion too? You know, what he's concentrating not just on what's coming from within, but more what does he think the other people want to hear? And that can be very characteristic of an abuse survivor too, someone who's that attentive to, you know, it's like, who has that please don't hurt me thing going on with them all the time. And I thought that was a very good way to show that part of his personality and that part of his struggle.
Mm-hmm. One thing, it was very visceral anytime it talked about the wounds starting to bleed. And I thought, has it never occurred to Anton to apply some bandages or something to just, you know, to be ready for that eventuality? But I think, you know, there's coping mechanisms that it's easy on the outside looking in to think you should be doing this, but self-care can be really, really difficult, especially coming out of a tough situation like that.
Well, I think you're being a bit fair to Anton. For some reason in my head, the wounds were very severe that I don't, you know, I think he would have bandaged them if he could, or if it would have helped. I think that the wounds are so intense or deep that,
sure,
you know, he can't really do anything he needs time to be away from Bird to heal. I don't know if they're completely gone by the end of the story or not. I mean, I think you got to give Anton a little bit more the bites, which I assume that they are a little bit more intense than you think they are.
Yeah, yeah, and that's fair, and they could be more like, you know, stigmata or something, where like if you looked just in any normal time, you wouldn't see them, but then they would manifest in the presence of the person. All right, anything else? This is kind of a short discussion on this one. If anybody else wants to speak up, go for it.
Well, I'll just say, the parts about why didn't they just walk away sooner, et cetera, that is very in tune with research I've read on abuse victims, the way they are groomed. There are a lot of people who will blame women who are domestically abused for why don't you just leave? And it's difficult unless you've either been there or spent a lot of time reading and looking at accounts of people who have been in those situations to understand how the grooming for them to stay victims is, even if it's not done consciously, it's very effective for making people feel like, really, I deserve this. Yeah.
Yeah. And isolating them.
And once you get someone to wear their own chains and lock themselves away, once a person has done that to themselves, it's almost like they're invested in that, because otherwise it's difficult to conceptualize that they did it to themselves to a degree. I'm not blaming, but they were manipulated to do that. And it's just extremely difficult to let go. And so I think Wiswell did a good job of showing you in that mindset. And really, I'm not sure that the wounds were so much caused by the vampire or whatever it is as things that the abuser induced these people to do to themselves. And maybe in a way it's even more power for the abuser parasite to that he's gotten them to do so much of this to themselves or to each other. It's even more powerful for him that way.
Mm-hmm. And even, you know, Mr. Bird has gotten them to be so much identified with him that he has them convinced that if they step outside the townhouse that they will, you know, be killed by the sun, which doesn't make any sense, but
right.
You become institutionalized, right?
Right.
All right. Why don't we go ahead and move on to Unseelie Brothers Limited by Fran Wilde. And Dan, are you taking that one?
I got that. So Unseelie Brothers Limited is a horribly sad story that I highly recommend for everybody. So I don't know if anyone agrees with me on that. It left me thinking about it for quite some time afterwards. It is one of the sad stories that are in this field. So I think of it, it's an interesting mix of fable and magical realism, I think. There's definite call to the stepmother trope that is in like Cinderella, Snow White. It's an interesting take on it. I don't mean that it just uses the trope. I mean that the trope exists there. You've got Vanessa Saunders that plays the role of the stepmother. Ray as a stepsister, although not quite as tyrannical as the stepsisters in Cinderella. Bo plays the role as the benevolent king. Dara, I believe female in the story, is the prince who rescues or attempts to rescue Sarah, the main character. Father Sam Sebastian is powerless, paralyzed by his own grief and his own loss, just like in many of these stories. And then the necklace is something of the glass slipper, I think, the necklace that Sarah gets. So I saw all those things there. I already see Cora has already raised her hand, so we're going to get the history probably behind it too that I didn't do right. but I really liked it because, like, it starts out, it sets the stage well for it. We get the difference between the haves and the have-nots very quickly, and these haves I don't understand very well because it's a have level that I don't have even in my have. But Fran Wilde does a really great job of describing what that looks like. And then the pain and the give and take that goes on here with the have not, Sarah. And I think there's an interesting quote I'm going to pull real quickly. Sarah Sebastian, that is the main character, was too uninterested and too poor to worry about the season. That's the ball season. And so, you know, growing up as I did, without a lot of money, that struck me immediately that there is a connection between being poor and not being interested in certain things. The newest Nike shoes were not interesting because there was no way I was going to get them anyway. And so, mm-hmm. you know, there's a, you know, probably a paradoxical frame of mind that goes on in a person's mind when they both can't afford it and therefore are interested and are interested because they can't afford it. And there's a give and take there. And Fran does a great job of pulling this out in Sarah's character. And then I'll turn it over to everybody here, but I want to, there's a great quote here about where Bo comes into the scene. He's the dressmaker, the artelier, I think. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but he's the shop owner, and he plays the role of the benevolent king. And the evil stepmother in the story says that the dress is for her daughter, not the other one. The other's not mine, she says. And then a few lines later, Bo, the benevolent king, says, then perhaps she's ours. And I just, like, right. That choked me up a little bit. It actually just kind of got me there right then. But we all want to belong. And I felt that in Sarah's character. And that's what I love about characters, when they can make me feel the same thing that I feel. And it's to kind of call back to our relatability discussion from earlier. You can mm-hmm. find relatability in characters that aren't like you. But I felt that. And so the story stuck with me a lot. Growing up the way I did, it hit me hard. It is a mixed ending. There is a lot of her finding truth, but the truth leaves you hungry, I think. And that was a good feeling to have to sit in. So that's kind of the backdrop to Unseelie Brothers Limited. I now turn it over to the group.
I mean, one thing that I like about it is that Sarah doesn't just blindly jump right into this situation. She realizes there are steps I can take to ensure that the thing that I want, I get, and also I don't have to give everything up. And so I thought that was a good moment when she amends the contract.
Well, about what Dan says, yes, it's a whole fairy tale tale ambience of the story and influence, and of course. One thing we didn't say is that the Unseelie, the Seelie and the Unseelie, it's a kind of fae or fairy. So basically, these are not human dressmakers. They're fae, and the fae may tend to kidnap people. They exchange babies with their own, which is possibly also why Bo thinks, oh, maybe she is one of ours. And she is, in the end. It turns out she's not a changeling, but she is one of theirs. So she's half fae. But what this also reminded me of was weirdly enough Jane Austen, because what we have here is we have the poor relation like Fanny Bryce or Elizabeth Bennet. We have the poor relation the right. girl with the girl from the mother married some the wrong kind of person because there were sisters, Vanessa Saunders and Sarah's mother, whose name I've forgotten, and she's vanished years ago. They were sisters, and they went to a ball in one of these gorgeous gowns from this Unseelie Brothers Limited shop, and Vanessa fell in love with and married the son of the richest guy in the room, and Sarah fell in love with a busboy and married the busboy, which was true love, but not really smart, but let's just say not a smart thing to do. Even Jane Austen would shake her head at that. Of course, we are no longer in the, and also the season is really, really important in Jane Austen and so on, the ball season. It's more, a lot more important than in debutantes and everything. These things still exist in the US, oddly enough, which always paints itself as very egalitarian, but it also exists in part of Europe. I think it's not so much a deal in Germany, but in Austria, there still are debutante balls. It's a Vienna Opera Ball. There still are girls in white dresses who are presented from rich families. This is just a so weird thing that it's also something I don't care about because I've also never been at that level to go to any of those things, even if they existed. I don't think we have them in my town, but if they existed, I've never been or had anything to do with it. But as a Jane Austen feeling is here, only that the ending is different because basically, okay, Sarah gets what she wants and gets to have the life she wants, but she doesn't get it, Mr. Darcy. She joins up with Dora, the other dressmaker woman, and has a fashion designer career because this is what a modern woman wants. She doesn't necessarily want Mr. Darcy, and instead she gets a Dora. Not sure if they are a couple. It's not really clear, but yes, I really liked this one. I was my previous experience with Fran Wilde's stories that were on the Hugo ballot was hit and miss, but this one is definitely a hit.
I get the Jane Austen. For me, this reminded me much more of the 1920s murder mysteries set in the British fashion world, of which there are a number because it's glittery and fun and so on. Marjorie Allingham is one example of a writer who's done that. So I kind of kept expecting there to be a murder. One of the things I liked about this is Sarah rewrites the contract. So I did not see Beau, the head of the fashion house, as a benevolent uncle. I saw him as someone who would maneuver people into contracts that they didn't realize what they were doing. And I saw it as a victory of her rewriting a contract. In one job offer, I remember actually crossing out parts of the intellectual property agreement they wanted me to sign because they wanted me to sign away everything pretty much. And I was not having it. I'm a lawyer's daughter. And so I liked that she had enough knowledge and enough self-protectiveness to look at that contract and fix it. So I enjoyed that sort of legal wrangling part of it. The other thing I wanted to mention was it was interesting to me how dangerous the dresses were. These fairy dresses might leave their wearers okay or better off, or they might each in their own way be the destruction of the person wearing the dress. And in the story, that seemed to be a little bit character-based as for, you know, people's motivations for going in and wearing these gowns. What kind? So there was a lot going on in this story. And I enjoyed the way that it sort of danced among different ideas and tropes.
Yeah, perhaps she'll drown in that dress.
Yes. Great line. that comes ominous. Back. Yes.
I like this story a lot, and just discussing it now, and this is, I think, the second story I read in that bunch. But now, and it's like I read them in groups of two over several days this last week. So this is among the first two. But now that we're discussing it, I'm seeing some things in common with some of the other stories. The fact that she and Dora get control of the shop by the end makes me think of O2 Arena with the protagonist getting hold of the gang and turning it to new ends. And I'm also struck by the fact that the color, the Joachim story, that this is a story about art. Albeit about, you know, dressmaking and, you know,
finding your voice,
you know, that I didn't see it that way at first, although I did kind of identify with her, with the protagonist's struggles and her desire to create. And so that was quote unquote relatable in that sense.
Right.
I will have to read it again for sure. But I also really want to see some fan art or illustrations or something of this story. Some of
the crown of thorns,
the dresses alone. Never mind the people wearing them or the balls or anything. Just the dresses.
Yeah.
But There's a lot of fabulous stuff going on here, for sure.
Yeah, first thing I want to remind people that the story is also an audio form, and it's read by the excellent Erica Enzine, who I'm a big fan of ever since she's been doing Doctor Who podcasts for Verity, and also married to a fellow fan. And she, full disclosure, I owe her a big favor. She loaned me her Hugo for a picture. And I was kind of intrigued when I saw the story, because I am a contributor to the Uncanny Kickstarter, so I do see when a new issue comes out, but sometimes I don't get to read it until the end of the year when I'm looking for stories on lists. And what struck me, I've always been fascinated by fairy myth, and even though I can't remember what are the characteristics of the two major courts, I always have to look that up. But when I saw Unseelie Court, I goes, oh, okay, it's a fairy story. And also, I do have a more modern look at fairies, that they're not Tinkerbells. They all have to be looked at with a critical eye, to put it in the nicest way, that they're not sweet and lovely, at least not all of them. And you have to be very careful when dealing with them. But also, I find the whole setup as fun. I also like, I need to get back at some time to Shauna McGuire's books that she's been doing in fairy mythology. So, and I thought this was very well executed. I need to reread it because as I said, I think I read it when it came out because the title intrigued me and heard it as an audiobook. So I kind of forgot some of the details. Some of this was reminding me of it. But I remember having a good feeling when I read this story, and it was a good addition to fairy lore.
This is the last one that I read this morning, actually, while I was walking my dog and reading on my device. So I wish I would have known it was a podcast. I would have just done it that way. I didn't realize. I got to the last page and I went, oh, because it says what episode it is. I regretted that. It's really cool having these conversations, because there's several of these novelettes that didn't make much of an impression on me. And then once we have the discussion, I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, there's something I didn't notice in there that I need to get back to.
Two things. First of all, I didn't realize that getting back into science fiction, I would slowly get drawn into enjoying fantasy. And I must admit, picking up on what people say, things about the Fae, etc. Even in the past 2 weeks, I've downloaded a book about fairies. I didn't quite expect that to happen. But anyway, going back to the story here, I actually was slightly disappointed, because I think it had lots of ideas and should have been longer. Mm. Thrashing out the mechanics of the shop, thrashing out the mechanics of how, what, where, and why. I felt a lot of it was unresolved and I wanted more. And when I compare it to like the Colors of the Immortal palette, everything was in that story you needed to know. But this left so many unanswered questions, and it tidied up the ending far too quickly for me. So I'd like to see something bigger.
I did think that it could have used a little more consequences, because there's the kind of Brigadoon element to it where the shop disappears and then it comes back. And even from week to week, it might be in different places before it completely disappears for who knows how long. So I did expect there at some point, there was a nod toward the idea that time functions differently in the shop. And I thought we were going to find that, she wasn't able to graduate because she had missed, months of classes or something.
I didn't like this story very much at the start and up until close to the end, because the main character read to me as, I get the Cinderella thing, et cetera, but also kind of Lieutenant Mary Sue, because she walks into this dress shop and suddenly you can be an apprentice here and get this extremely valuable necklace for just a couple of weeks of work.
And you're a wizard, Harry.
It seemed so fairy tale to me that I was like, oh, come on. And it's only at the end where we realize, oh, actually, they're treating her nice because she is one of them by race, or at least she's half Unseelie, half human. And then it all made sense, only in a, rather disgruntling way, because, of course, that's the way the world is. Families tend to favor their families over other people, even if they're kind of trying to exploit them at the same time, too. Bo wasn't about to tell her who she was or why she might have kind of a birthright. She had to find that out for herself. And so it's got kind of a tangle of feelings for me in the story.
Yeah. I didn't even know until Cora mentioned it earlier that Unseelie is something other than a name. This is how uninitiated I am in fantasy and fairy mythology.
Right. I think there is definitely some context littering the story, but only maybe if you already have some of the knowledge from other reading.
Yeah, yeah.
About what Iva said, that this one should have been longer. I actually agree. This one could have easily been a novella, or maybe even a novel, or even perhaps the start of an urban fantasy series. And maybe during the big urban fantasy boom of the 2000s, it would have been. But the boom is over, and nowadays only the established series and writers are still being published. Reminded me a bit of that. And this is interesting because with several others of these stories, I thought like, okay, I get it. There's an interesting idea here, but actually this goes on too long. This is an idea that could have been told in 2,000 or 5,000 words. We don't need 10,000, but here it's okay. This one has 10,000 words or however long it is, but it could easily have had 20 or 30,000.
Hmm. Okay. I think we are down to the last one, are we not? So we'll start talking about L'Esprit d'Escalier by Catherine M. Valenti, which means The Spirit of the Staircase. I'm going to go ahead and kick off the discussion about this one. I'm not going to go super detailed just because I didn't prepare anything, because I thought we were going to have somebody else doing this one. But this one kind of picks up the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, if you're familiar with that from mythology, where he has rescued his wife, quote, rescued his wife from Hades due to his beautiful music playing. And now it is the aftermath of that, where Eurydice is out of Hades, but she is still dead, and he's attempting to kind of revive her, make her more like a living person. But it's a very visceral story in the way it talks about the mold that grows on her, that has to be constantly, she has to be helped into the bath. She has to do all these exercises to try and limber up her limbs so that rigor mortis doesn't set in. It's just one of those stories that I find interesting, that kind of picks up on a mythological story and says, but was that actually a happy ending? Because of course Eurydice is kind of seen almost as his property in the story, and here you find out maybe she didn't want to come back and doesn't want to be here anymore. So I'll leave it to other people to kind of kick off the discussion about this one, but it was an interesting one. Anybody else want to jump in?
Just there has been a lot of stuff about Greek myths lately. And, you know, you've got Hades the Game, which was one of the nominations for Best Video Game last year for the Hugos. One of the graphic arts finalists this year has to do with, I think it's Persephone and that myth, only updated in nightclubs and so on. There are so many different interesting myth sets in the world. I don't quite know what's driving this recent focus. I mean, of course, it's a classic and all that, and people like doing their own takes on it. Once again, Catherine Valenti, great writer. yes, extremely yeah. Visceral, oogie, you know, stuff about yeah. The dead stuff, dead body and all of that. I mean, she's very good at what she does. Of her three finalists this year, this is the one that's in the middle for me. It was more readable than the short story to me. I just found that short story hard going. Okay, I'll stop.
Okay.
Well, I guess my impression was I think it's questioning whether Orpheus, you know, makes the right choice. I mean, should he have done this? Which I think, now that I'm thinking about this even more, I mean, this is a note I wrote like 6 months ago. That was always a question of the story. I mean, should he have gone back? Because obviously in the traditional story, things don't go, I mean, it all goes kablooey at any point. So this story cannot end well. So I think that was a big question. I mean, why do? And then it goes into something that I know a lot of people are burnt out on. It comes off like a zombie, although she does it in a way which I don't find annoying. I mean, you're talking about somebody who decided to wash their hands of The Walking Dead when they captured Negan, if that means anything to anybody, that's, I'm just saying that's when I gave up on the show because I was just tired of it. But she did it in a way that I think kept it fresh and kept it engaging, and I think, you know, it's a good take of the classic story in the modern era.
Yeah. I mean, credit to the writing is due, you know, reading it, I can smell like mildew as I'm reading it. So,
yeah. So you just said something that I wanted to, you said you smelled the mildew. And and so like there's a little short section that I thought was really neat. What does she do all day? Mostly Eurydice. Thank you. Practices fine motor control. I realize I just ruined it for everybody because I couldn't get the name out. But it was all explained to him at the time. Though Orpheus didn't want to hear it then, she has to stay active mentally and physically. She has to keep moving. Rigor mortis sets in again so fast, and she forgets not just how to move her fingers, but what fingers are and why moving is good and desirable goal. And so one thing that I like in kind of the modern takes on these old stories, and we had it in the Unseelie Brothers Limited too, where we get more detail, I think, in many senses that draws us in, all of our senses, actually, that allows us to see, feel, hear, and touch, even just from the written word on the screen. And you know, motivations for the characters aside, I love talking about those. But also, this was just really good writing, particularly whether you like the story and the visceral feeling of it or not. I think the story was good in that it was really well written. The sensory input is really well done.
Well, we are seeing a lot more retellings of Greek mythology. I think it's probably, we've been seeing a lot of retellings in general lately. At first, it was fairy tale retellings, and apparently now we've exhausted the fairy tales and moved on to Greek mythology, which is at least a different. Maybe it will be Norse mythology or something else in 2 or 3 years. So, yes, as for the story, it asks the questions, yeah, okay, Orpheus wanted to get Eurydice back, but is this really a great idea? In this one, it obviously isn't. So it's one of those, a lot of stories end at the happy or unhappy ending, and this basically tells you what happens after. It reminds me of something which is not genre at all, but it's a play called, It Was a Lark. I have to look it up. I saw it in high school years ago by Ephraim Kishon, who's an Israeli author. And it basically tells, what if Romeo and Juliet had lived? They had not killed themselves. They survived. They got together. They were married for for 20 years and so on. And they're basically arguing all the time. They're not happy because they were teenagers when they got together. They're not happy, and they're still arguing about whether it was the lark or the nightingale. And it's a hilarious play. It's very, very funny. Kishon is very funny, is a very funny writer anyway. For some reason, he's not as well known. He's very popular in Germany, but he's not very well known in the English-speaking world. Well, and this is basically not very funny, because, again, this is a depressing story. Take on the Orpheus and Eurydice myths. Okay, one question is, okay, what's the message here? Is it you can't get the dead back, or you can't turn back time? For a while, I thought maybe it's an issue for aging and dementia, because Eurydice constantly needs help with everything. She has to be bathed, and everything has to be done, and her personality is changing or fading. But on the other hand, there's also the question asked later on by Sisyphus, who, of course, if you know Greek mythology, is a person who does futile work.
Right.
Who always pushes the boulder up the hill, which is also why he wears the t-shirt that says rock and roll forever, because he constantly pushes the boulder up the hill for it to fall down again. And Sisyphus basically asks him, like, okay, but did you even know anything about Eurydice? Because it turns out Orpheus doesn't know anything. She was a pretty girl and a sort of groupie for him.
Right.
Groupie. He picked up at a party, even though he slept with someone else at the time. And married, she's not, he doesn't know anything. He has no idea that she likes dogs and that she likes wool and dying wool. He knows nothing about her. Mm-hmm. About her. And in the end, well, basically, they break up. Both go back where they are happier. He to the living and a warm living body of I think it's a maenad or something. And she goes back to the dead, to the land of the dead, where she was actually happy.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like this is the most depressing of the stories. It's the most downer.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. With this being the most depressing, although there are some lively aspects to it. Sarah was alluding to the Hugo finalist about the Persephone and Hades, and Lore Olympus, which that I made that connection to. I was very taken with a lot of the supporting cast in here. You know, Apollo and his entourage, and Calliope, trying to be the good mother here, and but being a little intrusive at the same time. And Sisyphus trying to be, you know, the good friend, but also, you know, getting into some uncomfortable issues there. It's interesting because there are so many people who've done takes on the Orpheus and Eurydice story over time. It was a popular subject for early for some of the earliest opera writers, for instance. You have stuff like the Jean Cocteau film of Orpheus, which is also kind of a modernist take on it. And I'm sure there's room for a whole lot more, but this one was unrelenting in kind of starting with the premise, starting with he doesn't fail this time. He succeeds in getting her back from the dead, but at what cost? You know, you have zombie Eurydice, essentially. I thought it was fascinating. The one time that she puts on the makeup for the company, and it's like she looks, you know, pretty human, except she forgot to do her hands. And it's still, yeah. And people are still put off by that. And, you know, as, you know, kind of, you know, funny and tragic all at once there.
Yeah.
And it made me think of the issues of dealing with someone with dementia, but to any other, you know, stories of, you know, some where you have something symbolizing people trying to stave off death or the final ending, you know, by whatever means possible. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, yeah, it was a depressing story, but there's a lot in there for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm glad I read it. So. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I do love a depressing story.
Is that a British thing?
It will be. However, I would find actually this discussion, I'm getting more out of it rather than the first reading, because if you dress things up in kind of Greek or Latin, it tends to put me off, because that wasn't something I was taught at school. I was in the wrong sort of mainstream schooling for that. So I took it from a different angle. And from the point of view of such as the Orpheus, I actually think he had probably what I've now called post-survivor guilt. He's brought his love back, and now he regrets it. Yeah. But I also give the author much credit as to how difficult it is to keep the dead looking living. Now, don't get too freaked out by this, but I touched on this in the previous panel. I have served in as a nurse or a nursing assistant many, many years ago, seen lots of dead bodies. And one of the things you have to do is actually make them quite presentable when they die. Mm-hmm. So doing this full time would be quite an ongoing task. So I did quite enjoy the depression and the decay. So well done to the author once I got past the Greek stuff.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated to hear all these takes on the story as depressing, because to me it's a triumph. Orpheus is a jerk from start to finish. He never changes. Some jerks never change and evolve. What do you stay with them forever, or do you say, I'm gonna live my life? And in this story, she was so unhappy with marriage, with being with him, that she preferred death.
Yeah.
And then he dragged her back. And even when they went to couples counseling, he keeps answering for her, contradicting what she says, what she knows is the truth. The therapist calls him on it and says, I'm asking her. You have to let her talk. And he still keeps talking over him, over her. He's a monster. He's an abuser, not a physical abuser, but he has made her, you know, she stops. It says in there that she stopped fighting with him because he loved to fight, and she eventually got tired of it. So I was joyful when he's got his career, let him go off, let him think she's beyond saving or whatever. She's happy, you know, she's joyful that, you know, he's gone, baby. And so for me, it's a triumph because she manages to work herself free of the prison he's put her in and have her own existence. I won't say life.
Right.
And, you know, she's laughing and he just still doesn't get it at the end. And that is like it is somehow. Some people never understand, you know, the am I the asshole website. Right. Some people never understand. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. and you can't convince them. And it's such a waste to try. You know, I mean, it's everybody's judgment call on how much effort to spend trying to talk with people who will not listen, who will talk over you, who will believe their own narrative over what the actual facts are. It's exhausting. And I was glad that she was able to laugh and have, you know, her friends at the end who loved her for what she was, this dead, rotten creature, but they loved her, you know? Mm-hmm. So great. Good for her. I saw it as a happy ending.
Okay. That's interesting. I mean, that recontextualizes it for me. And this is one, I think it was one of the first ones I read. And so I may have to go back, and I didn't get to double back on any of these, but, but yeah, that's a good perspective.
It's true. Orpheus is pretty much a monster in this version of the story for sure. And arguably, Valente hasn't really done anything with him that's not implicit in some of the earlier versions of the story. And also what we know about some of the, you know, the pitfalls of successful musicians, sometimes successful artists in other fields, you know, and, cause he really is, you know, he's narcissistic, but also that is reinforced by, you know, by the nature of his gift and the way he's used it. Someone who has always been able to get what he wants through playing music and, you know, cause it comes easy to him. So, I mean, that's, you know, it's a good life if you can manage it, I guess. But in this, and it may be that, you know, part of the reason for the original Greek myth, of him falling in love with marrying someone and then her dying so suddenly and so young, meant to show him up. And this kind, and it you know, it seems to turn that myth on its head, but also kind of shows them up in a different way, I guess you could say, by, you know, contextualizing, as mentioned before, how little he really knows about the woman he supposedly loves. And, and you know, is he really caring for her, or just does he, as her or as Eurydice, who she is, or just because she's an extension of him? So,
right.
Well, about what Sarah said, I think it is a sort of, it's a depressing story, but it is also a sort of happy ending for both Orpheus and Eurydice, because he gets to go back to his rock star life and his nymph lover, and probably the next lover and the next lover. And she gets to go back to the land of the dead with her dead pals and Cerberus, who's her pet and whom she takes which is interesting because the Hades game, which won last year's video game, Hugo, also basically portrays Cerberus, the three-headed hell dog, as he's a family dog. He's a pet. He's a puppy. He's not. He may look terrible, but he's an affectionate dog. And this is also how he's portrayed here, which is a take I like. Like, so basically, they both, and she gets to dye her wool, and they're both happy. They're happier apart. This is a basic. This is also, you could also use this as a story about a bad about people realizing that getting out of a bad relationship and living apart is healthier than trying to stay together for the sake of appearances or children or whatever.
Yeah, I was reminded, Ivor, what you're talking about the efforts that it take to make a dead person look good, right? That reminded me of a book I used to read very widely on all kinds of topics, because my local library system had an RSS feed for all the new materials. And so I'd just be like, yeah, I'll request that. And I read one a while back called Mortuary Confidential. And it was all just little chapters from morticians talking about their arts. And I remember there was one where a guy was relating a story where he was at, I can't remember if he was at a friend's house who was either hungover or drunk, and she was trying to get ready to go out and couldn't do her makeup. And she said, "Hey, you do makeup for dead people. Can you do mine?" And she stood in front of him, hoping for him to do it. And he said, "Actually, I need you to lie down because I can't do makeup on someone standing up." So... anything else that we want to talk about this story? Or we can move into kind of wrap up and final thoughts. It sounds like it. Okay. Kind of closing statement, if anybody has anything, if you want to talk about, you know, where your votes are going or what your, you know, number one or number two stories are, go ahead and do that. No pressure. Not everybody has to do it. And we won't hold you to it, even if you say what you're going to vote for.
I like this ballot, but I don't like the novel. I don't think it's quite as strong as last year's novelette ballot or the short story ballot, because a lot of these stories were like, oh, this is a nice story, this is an interesting story, but there's not really, very few of these really knocked my socks off. They're good, good, but they're not quite as, it's more of a bit of an average ballot, I think. As for which one my top are, at the moment, it's a struggle between, there's none of these is, they're all good stories. There's none that will go under no award or even close to no award. But at the moment, my top three are Bots of the Lost Ark, O2 Arena, and Unseelie Brothers Limited. And that is the struggle between the, which is interesting because except in novella, where I was pretty clear early on which one would be my top in all other three, in the other categories, novel and short story and novelette, it's currently three or four stories struggling for the top spot.
I liked most of the stories on the ballot a lot. Even L'Esprit d'Escalier, you know, which I found depressing, it still had a lot of terrific stuff in it. Some of them I found pretty surprised. You know, I can imagine stronger ballots, but and I do have some very clear favorites too. So far my favorite is the Bots of the Lost Ark too. That one I just started laughing my head off periodically and just had to put it down every now and then. And most intense reaction to. Second place for me was the, never remember the title, sorry, the Colors of the Immortal Palette. As far as the one that is just delved into depth on some of my own personal preoccupations and in very perceptive and very probing kinds of ways. And third place might be O2 Arena, because that, as I said, it had a lot to say in it. There's a lot of terrific relationship between the principal characters and the and also, you know, description both of the not just of the difficulties of the future where O2 is rationed and sold, but the societies and the societies within societies, you know, both academia and the gang world in this. And yeah. Very well done overall and terrifyingly relevant to stuff going on today. So, yeah.
I think for me, my top two are the same as yours, actually, Rob.
Okay.
I'm more of a science fiction fan and Bots of the Lost Ark. Just tickled me. And then, yeah, I really like Colors of the Immortal Palette as well.
Those are also my top two.
Awesome. Okay. So, since you just spoke up, Sarah, why don't you go ahead and give any contact information you want to?
Sure. Before we sign off. I'm active on Twitter. My handle there is Configures. I tweet there about DevOps and science fiction and other things. I post pretty pictures sometimes.
Cool. All right. Juan, any contact information you want to give out?
Yeah, I'm usually on Twitter at RainbowWar71. I'm also on Facebook, but I know that's not as popular to some. And you can find all my info on either of those two places.
Okay. How about you, Dan?
I, as you mentioned earlier, I'm the host of a podcast called Coffee in Space. We talk about science fiction and fantasy characters, and I have conversations with the authors of the books and some short stories. Sometimes we get to short stories. And the easiest way to get anything from Facebook to Twitter to the podcast itself is just go to the website, www.coffeeinspacepodcast.com. It's all one word, coffeeinspacepodcast.com.
Cool. How about you, Rob?
Well, I don't have anything particular to promote. I'm on Twitter at, you know, under my own name, pretty much. Maybe I should have picked a different name, but that's okay. And
I feel like you can blame your parents for that.
Oh, well, okay. Yeah. okay, I'll do that in the future. Anyway, periodically have opinions on science fiction, fantasy, comics, movies, music, and stuff going on generally. So, yeah.
Okay. Ivor, do you have any... I know you're on Twitter technically. Are you actually on Twitter?
I was thinking about this. Everybody else is outshining me as usual. So I am on Twitter. I'm on Tears of the Tin Man is the handle I use. I more follow and stalk and read rather than actively. But yes, maybe I need to be a bit more active. So
I'm glad you found me because I like that we made this connection because it's a delight to have you.
Thank you. But that's fine. If you want to add me, that's fine. If not, I've got lots of notes to go and follow people. So don't worry.
All right. Cool. last but not least, Cora.
Well, you can find my blog at corabulert.com. That's CoraBulert. And you can find me on Twitter as also under at Cora Bulert, again, CoraBulert. And if you go to my blog, you can also find links to my books. And sometimes you find me at Galactic Journey, where I review the science fiction and fantasy of 55 years in the past. So it's 1967 in the Summer of Love right now.
Nice. And for me, you can usually find me on Twitter at Hugo's Podcast. I also have just at Heasley Seth, but I very rarely actually use that one. Figure I'll just keep it all unified on the podcast. So, well, thank you everybody for doing this. I really appreciate it. I know this is all just kind of slapdash, last minute kind of stuff. We literally planned this in the last 6 days. So thank you for being willing. I love my internet friends. Thank you for doing it.
Thanks, everybody. Okay. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. This is a lot of fun. Thank you.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're listening to this in the podcast feed, you can find a video version of it that I will post before the podcast one goes up, by a few minutes at least. And there will be links in the video one to the audio and in the audio one to the video. So hope you enjoyed it. If you want to react on YouTube or on Twitter or any other place, let us know what you thought of these novelettes and make sure to give all these good people a follow. And make sure to vote for Cora in the Hugos this year. All right. Thanks, everybody. I'm going to hang up now. No, I'm going to hang up. I'm going to hit stop on the recording. There we go.
Gotcha.
I'm a professional
recording
podcaster.
Recording stopped.
Okay. I just realized I didn't hit record. Dang it. Let me try that again. Maybe I'll get the... I hit record, and then it pops up the little flyaway that says record on the computer or record to the cloud. All right. Sorry.
It's all dry.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. All right. I'm going to start over.